Hello, welcome to Diving Into the Wreckage, FAFO World Historic Edition.
Oh my god, this is like a bit of an emergency pod, I guess, emergency episode. Not sure how much else there is to talk about. I mean, I know that there's a lot more to talk about, but kind of everything else being drowned out right now, of course, by the attack of the United States and Israel's military upon Iran. What was that, Saturday?
Or Saturday.
Overnight on Friday?
It was Friday. I mean, we went to bed on Friday. Friday night, we woke up Saturday. Week before, I recorded something prior about with the Regrettable Century Gang, and I had said, like, I refuse to make a prediction on Iran because everything feels inevitable until it doesn't. And then,
the three of us recorded a news episode last week, and the way we left things was that we didn't want to talk about Iran because there was a chance that by the time the episode came out, we'd already be at war with Iran. Mm-hmm. But it turns out it took another 5-6 days for that to happen. So we've all kind of had this impending sense of disaster, except for, as it turns out, the Trump administration, which has jumped both feet first into what seems like an abyss, to be quite honest. I'm a habitually optimistic person, but I've lost it in this case. I don't know. There doesn't seem to be a plan. This is spiraling very quickly into a regional war, completely unpredictable. There's going to be knock-on effects, obviously, through the economy globally and regionally. And at this point right now, I feel like I don't know what you and I can do. We can try to cut through some of the noise and madness and the spinning that's happening on both sides. I feel like maybe where you and I might be best at is trying to take a kind of 500-foot kind of Archimedean view above this sort of thing and try to put it into context. I did listen to you and Gene, your stream yesterday, and he obviously has a wealth of knowledge about the internal dynamics of the region, which I would never claim to have. So I'm not an expert in that respect. Where do you want to go with talking about this?
One of the things I will say about my expertise, I'm not an expert in the Middle East, but I did live there.
You did live there. That is true. Yeah.
And what I'm going to say, however, is that aside, I know Sunni countries and I know the complicatedness of Sunni Gulf North African politics pretty well. And I know the way the Israelis have played that. I actually don't really understand Iran. I've always had to trust, let's say, leftist friends of mine who were part of the Iranian diaspora, of which there have been many in my life.
Me too.
Even the right wing Iranian diaspora in California, for example, which I have met a couple of times, but I've never like dealt with. So when I ask, like, you know, even sincere questions about the Iranian community in America, like how many of these people are now now Shahist, and I get wildly varying answers. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I think it's always dangerous to rely on like any particular milieu, especially a diasporic one, to try to understand events as though, they obviously have a common background with people living on the ground in Iran. I'm talking about the Persian communities in Los Angeles or to the extent that they exist elsewhere in the country. Obviously, the people fled for a reason. Sometimes it was economic, but largely it was ideological, you know, after 79 with the revolution. And it's difficult to know how much those people are in tune with what's on the ground. There's a great figure in history, a world historic figure, maybe we could call him, named Ahmed Chalabi. If people remember back to the very beginnings of this global war on terror, maybe which we're still in, maybe this current war is like the end of the war on terror and the beginning of something new, maybe World War III. But regardless, Varun, I'm sure you remember Ahmed Chalabi. He was like a journeyman political operative and diasporoid, I suppose you could call him, of Iraqi background. He formed the Congress of Iraqi Freedom, I think it was, which was like a civil, social, political group in the West. And he fed the CIA and anybody who had listened for decades on all sorts of like rosy pictures of what it would look like when Saddam Hussein was overthrown. Of course, he imagined that he would be riding in on an American tank to take over for Saddam Hussein. But as we all know, the picture was not quite so rosy there in Iraq. And I'm not accusing anybody that we know of being an Ahmed Chalabi type. It's only to point out that the United States and the West in general has all sorts of expat diaspora communities who, you know, have left their homelands and are now setting up shop, putting a shingle up in Washington or Stockholm or London or whatever. And these people are obviously self-interested. Whether they're right or wrong is an open question. It's probably a case-by-case question. But certainly they're self-interested and they have a political bone to pick, right? A political project.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I find interesting about this, I think we can talk about, like, the weaponization of Iranian diaspora and getting people to celebrate the bombing of their own country on television. And I want to say something that I think is going to surprise people. The cravenness of the Democrats in a lot of this has been a little bit stunning. And I say craven because they're trying to have it both ways, just like they did in the Iraq War. And this is a generation of progressives that came into being in the Iraq War. For example, you have Rachel Maddow trying to spin that it's the Gulf states who wanted this war, not the Israelis. and that Trump was fooled by Saudi Arabia, even though Saudi Arabia is now on record as saying they feel abandoned by the Trump administration because our missiles are too expensive. So we pulled them out.
Yeah, and left them holding the bag as we put our defensive missiles to protect Israel. Go on. There's more to say about Saudi. But yeah, Rachel Maddow blames the Gulf states and the Saudis for this.
Jones was having Pavlovsky on his fucking show. Like I knew that a lot of these anti-war progressives from when you and I were in our early 20s were pretty thin from their lack of opposition to the Obama administration. But I didn't think they would literally regress to the Democratic Party that was in power during the compassionate conservative time period of George Bush. For those of you who don't remember, that was when the Democrats were continuing their Clinton era policy goals, and in the fervor after 9/11 would not stand up to a president who went from very unpopular to extremely popular very quickly. The difference between now and then is there's no 9/11 turning American opinion pro this war. This right. is divided even the conservative base. Frinty sounds like Richard Spencer. For those of you who don't know, that's the Winston Spencer had his breaking point with Trump, and Trump won over Syria. And now he's basically a fucking Democrat talking about how he misses George W. Bush.
He's a log cabin Republican.
Yeah. He endorsed Biden. And now Frentis is saying, don't vote or vote for the Democrats in the next elections. Now, I think the cognitive dissonance on this is too much for people. Trump team knows a lot of, I mean, there are going to be a lot of Republican chuds who will go with anything the administration says.
Right.
I mean, like 60% of Republicans who are like 30% of the population. So
sure.
Not a huge amount, but enough to be really annoying.
and right. loud, and also right. have various mouthpieces cater to them. Right. I don't want to sidebar us, but I was at the library today and they have all the different newspapers, and I had the benefit of reading the New York Post, you know, which you should always read these things to kind of see what the chuds out there think, or at least what the yellow Murdoch press wants us to think. And yeah, it's like the last 23 years never happened. So I agree. There's going to be some minority of Americans who are Trump diehards, Republican diehards, really. And the blood feud with the mullahs, with the Ayatollahs, has been going on for literally our entire lives, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, it arguably starts in 79. It's clear what it is by 81, you know. But I also want to point out, as much as the Empire has wanted this, there's been forces within the Empire who have fought against it. Otherwise, it already would have happened.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We had our big proxy war in the 1980s, right? We fought a proxy war against Iran. We gave
It's how Iraq got its beginnings of WNDs. It's what shored up the Ba'athist regime.
American chemical weapons. And of course, we sold weapons to both sides. That's what Iran-Contra was about. Interesting connections there with Jeffrey Epstein, I think, showing not his alleged cannibalistic satanic pedophilia, but instead his connection to networks of power and money laundering and arms laundering across the world. So that's an interesting thing to look at as we face what some wags online have called not Operation Epic Fury, but Operation Epstein Fury. Epstein, of course, being like a great moniker now to just hang over your enemies' necks. I'm not sure it means much more than that, but maybe it does. The point is, as you said, there have been forces working in both directions. Famously, of course, Iran became, or at least offered to become, our ally during the War on Terror, during the immediate aftermath of 9/11. They were going to help break up terrorist networks in the region that might have been associated with Al-Qaeda. So there was a little bit of a thawing, although I don't think the U.S. Ever really took them up too strong on that offer. It was like similar to Putin saying that Russia would like to join NATO. You know, it was one of these moments where there was a possibility of things to shift in a different direction, for there to be some sort of diplomatic rapprochement between that regime and our regime, but it didn't work. And then, of course, there's the JCPOA, right, which by all indications, of course, was working. It only had about 2 years to work, right? 2014, Obama gets it signed, but fatefully, of course, does not go through the Senate to make it a treaty. So therefore, it was very easy for Trump to get rid of it in, what was it, 2018?
Yeah. Right? I mean, that the issue with people going, America isn't a reliable partner anymore, is that our legislative branch has historically abnegated any kind of responsibility. Yeah. And this is part of their political games to do so. When we talk about the long durée, I think we do have to get into specifics here, because the regional complications are going to spiral out of control very quickly, as they already are. Yeah. There is already a Pakistan-Afghan war going on. There are increased tensions around China and Iran. Not China against Iran, but China's been running military exercises. It's unclear whether or not they're willing to go to war with it. The answer is probably not.
You're talking about war around Taiwan or war?
No, around
Iran.
Yeah, but they are losing, you know, up to 20% of their oil supply just got cut off. Which means also Europe's oil supply is being cut off in retaliation by the Iranians and the unofficial closure of the Strait of Hormuz. It is unofficially closed, but the Revolutionary Guard is not letting anyone through, and the insurance companies are not insuring anyone to go through.
And the two largest European shippers, which are, what's it, Hagad Lloyd and MSC, I believe, are the two major ones, both said that they're going to stop using the Street of Hormuz for insurance reasons and logistical reasons. So that is more than oil, right? That is the LNG, the liquefied natural gas supply to Europe, which again, fatefully, some years back, I guess it's like, 3.5 years ago, their Russian suppliers were cut off with the mysterious explosion of the Nord Stream pipelines. And so then I guess this is one more reason for them to be in hock to the United States again, because now that Qatari...
Except they've already said that they're going to go to the Russians to get their energy sources.
They are going to go back to the Russians. Hopefully the Russians will have them for their sake.
Yes,
these things are spiraling very, very quickly as we speak.
A lot of the drone commanding post and missile commanding post in the Gulf states were hit. The only regional ally that has American bases that was not targeted by Iran was the Turks and the Azerbaijanis. So
do you suspect that the Turkey is because they don't want to invoke Article 5 of the NATO?
I suspect that's part of it. I also suspect Erdogan is more willing to reach out to them despite the Saudis and inter-Sunni regional competition, which is something people know very little about. The UAE and Saudis are not so trusting of Erdoganist or the Qataris. This has been something that's, been going on for a long time. The alliance with the Gulf states have with the U.S. and their detente, our unofficial alliance with Israel is the only thing that's been keeping that together. Mm. This blows that off. It's also clear that the Hezbollah purges of the military brass had an effect, but even the military brass is leaking that they aren't happy about this. It right. really and totally and truly looks like the Israelis convinced Trump that he could pull a Maduro. That's the only thing we've gotten from them.
Yeah.
There's been strategic silence on all other from this administration, except now that more Americans are going to die, and now there's talk of eventually troops on the ground, because of course there is. You can't do this with just air power.
No, if you're going to keep with the we have to talk about, of course, the shifting rationale for this, but like the obvious one, and I think the one that makes the most sense given not just this war but also the 12-day war in June is a air war which seeks regime change. Of course, there's the subsidiary ideas that this is to eliminate the ballistic missile threat, which is impossible, of course, because these are missiles are all dug deep into mountains and there's mobile launchers. And then of course there's the nuclear threat, right, such as it is as well, which is absurd. And as everyone's pointed out, I'm sure you recognize the absurdity of Trump saying in June that it was obliterated. So now it's still a threat and we're going to get rid of that. Of the three, it seems like the regime change one makes the most sense given what we've seen so far with American and Israeli strikes, taking out the top brass. They seem to be attacking IRGC, which is the Revolutionary Guard leadership, and also their installations, but also local police and Basjid. Is that what it's called? Basij?
Yeah.
The Islamic police. And then calling for the people to rise up. So if this is like an overriding goal of your operation, I agree. There's no way that this happens, of course, without troops on the ground. Or let's be honest, without the use of a tactical or a regular nuclear weapon, which I've grudgingly seen on the horizon for months now as Israeli regime becomes more and more aggressive, assertive, and it seems now desperate. We should talk about this relationship between Israel and the United States, Israel and the Trump administration, because I find it very hard to believe that the Israeli leadership believed that the Islamic Republic could be overthrown simply using air assets. Now, I think that there was an opportunity missed for them last month when those protests, which were probably semi-organic, but definitely had a component that was a color type revolution, right? If this operation we're seeing right now had coincided with that mass, semi-mass uprising, then perhaps you could imagine a way that you could get away with this without escalating to boots on the ground. But without the forces on the ground, you're hoping for a miracle. You're hoping that the intelligence that says that this regime was already on its last legs is correct. And there's no indication to me that that's true.
No. I actually want to be, I want to add some nuance to that. Because,
yeah, please.
It's not just that the Israelis and the Americans seem to have been targeting the local police, although I had someone respond, well, the police were suppressing the protesters and that's why they did it. And I'm like, you know what? Police suppressing protesters is a given. That's what they fucking do.
That's what they do, right?
I think the bigger and more questionable issue is like if someone was doing that in the United, it's like, for example, if someone wanted to liberate the United States from ICE, and of course local cops sometimes cooperated with ICE and they blew up every local police station, I would not assume that they were actually trying to liberate me. The particularly when they're saying they don't necessarily want regime change. Which, again, how do you not want regime change when you're blowing up every police station? But let's also add who else they killed, Sean.
Yeah.
They killed Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, okay? Former hardliner, president and opponent of the U.S. from 2005 to 2013.
One of the people that, if you're our age, you remember very well, because this was the War on Terror times, and so he was right. the president, famously, of Iran during that time.
Right, exactly. But, he had been under house arrest because of his clashes with the supreme leaders in Inner Circle, and for being too hardline against Israel. Okay, I guess that makes some sense. You don't want him being a rump power. But then they also went for Mir Hussein Mousavi, who was the former prime minister and primary leader of the Green Movement. Who's been under house arrest since 2011. It looks very much like they tried to hit his house. So it looks like they were trying to take out the liberal and conservative internal oppositions to the country so that they could do what exactly? The regional ethnic tensions of the Iranians that Gene talked about on my podcast the night before we were recording this. This was recorded on March 2nd, and this will be released probably very soon, actually. I don't think we can hold this one back. Yeah. But there's a lot of regional tensions that this flares up, but nobody, you know, like the Kurds aren't going to be happy about the Shahs coming back. The Baluchistanis aren't either. So what do you expect will happen? The best thing I can see them doing is trying to install some rump government in Tehran that's totally outside for a show for the diaspora and to Syrianize everything else. That's what I think the Israelis are doing. And that's, really truly seem like the Trump administration believed its own supply that they could just Maduro this.
Yeah.
Now, we know that there were a lot of Israelis on the inside of the Iranian Republic, because they knew where these people were.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to sound crazy, because for most of my life, I've been on team that Israelis are by and large a proxy for the Western powers. Mm. They are independent. They have their own agenda, but they are a proxy because they are also a Frankenstein's monster of our own creation.
Mm.
Since 2015, it does seem like there has been no force of American society willing to stand up to them, no matter how much they bullshit us. And at the same time, this is at precisely the moment where popular opinion of Israel has started to decline rapidly. I bring this up because it is, I'm just going to say, from the standpoint of the American empire, this only makes sense if they were sold something by the Israelis and they got wagged the dog. It does not make sense from the standpoint of imperial maintenance. I've been trying to read this as, like, you know, a rational extension of Western power. But okay, so let's talk about some other effects that have already happened immediately. France is talking about upping its nuclear warheads and expanding those warheads to Poland.
Guys, there was an hour or so ago, if people haven't got the news yet, I'm not even sure this is going to make the news, because the START treaty, for example, running out, happened a couple of months ago, and it barely got a fucking blip, like, in the Western press. So Macron came out with a press conference and said exactly what Derek said, which is that they're going to up their arsenal, and also they're basically making this move to try to replace the American nuclear umbrella over NATO, over Europe, with their own. So it's an incredible power move on their part, because ultimately, as we've seen with U.S. power, not the only reason, but one of the main reasons is that they provide the apocalypse weapons, right? Which, if anybody attacks NATO, will immediately lead to the end of humanity. Well, now France is taking up that role. Interestingly, if you look and you imagine rearmament in East Asia, Japan talking about changing its constitution to have an offensive military,
Germany's rearming, like
Germany rearming, maybe the power of Israel, the Israeli attempt with American support to try to create a kind of Pax Judaica hegemony over the Middle East makes sense, perhaps, in this context, if America is going to pull back from the Middle East after this, allow Israel to have its fiefdom and allow it to run the Middle East. But that, it doesn't seem clear to me that there is a pivot to Asia happening, or that this is part of Trump's attempt to get us out of the Middle East. At least that rhetoric isn't explicit right now. Maybe it's implicit in Trump's increasingly addled brain. Maybe there's people within his administration who see this as a step to America pulling back. I think that maybe, and I don't, it's a little early to talk about silver linings, but, like, at a certain point, America, the United States, when the dust is settled from this war, if we don't all get blown up in a nuclear Armageddon, it's going to have to decide whether and how much to rebuild all of these bases, which Iran said it was going to absolutely glass, and it has, with a combination of Shahid drones and Fatah missiles and whatnot, short range, medium range.
Which are way cheaper for them to, it's the same problem that you have with the Houthis, too. It is cheaper for them to produce these, like, mid-technology weapons that can be hid in a, like, literally they can be launched out of the back of a semi.
Are we going to rebuild these bases, is the question, when this is all said and done? Because when we lose this war, and I'm convinced right now, because you're, Varun, you're bringing up the idea of an attritional air war. The numbers don't look good for the United States and the West. If we're producing 400 interceptors per year, and it's reported that Iran can produce 1,000 missiles, like, you do the math on that entire thing. The question is, like, are we going to rebuild? Is this our final war in the Middle East? Is this ultimately going to lead for us to be forced to pull back, as opposed to what, put another $50 billion into rebuilding all of these radar systems and air defense systems and naval bases and air bases that are, in as we speak, being fucking literally obliterated, not like the obliterator that Trump stands up and talks about with the airstrikes in June, but, like, actually being wrecked right now. Maybe this is our last shot. Maybe this is the last shot. And some people have guessed that that's perhaps what the Israelis were thinking, is that America had one last war in it. So shoot the load and then they can move on, I guess, to like bigger and better things and hopefully maybe be able to do the next one on their own. We'll see.
In what world does a country as small as Israel do the next one on their own? Against with a nation that army is
too?
With a conscript army against a nation that is literally over 10 times larger in population, unless they're willing to use nukes.
I mean, I think this is where it leads into your theory of where this might be going, which is a Syrianization of Iran, or maybe right. What you were saying, like the center, maybe you'd have some sort of not Dilma Rousseff. What's the name of the woman who's in charge after Maduro now?
Delcy Rodriguez?
Yeah, finding some members of the IRGC who will be like the winning puppets of the United States, maybe in the center, in the Farsi regions, and then let the outside regions go. Maybe that's the plan. I don't know.
Why would you trust them? Because this is another piece of context to just add. They know what happened to Gaddafi. And the Omanis are literally sharing, and the Omanis are usually pretty good neutral parties in all of this. They're their own form of Islam, Ibadi. Nobody really likes them. They're the split in the Islamic Ummah that no one talks about, but they often play a mediating role between the West and the Shia and Sunni conflicts. And the Omanis said that the Iranians were willing to give Trump a better deal. And this still happened. They were about to agree to a lot of the concessions. But since I guess it wasn't total, because they still had to have some legitimacy internally, Trump walked away. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not here. People have like, oh, you're defending the Iranian regime. I'm like, look, I'm not here to pretend like the Iranian regime was a left-wing regime. I'm not here to talk about this and those kind of moral terms. But what it is clear is even if like people like Rashid Khalidi and a lot of Palestinian advocates are a little bit more ambivalent on the axis of resistance than say even some leftists are, it is clear to me that the Islamic Republic had two things going for it that made it different from a lot of these other regimes. It was not personalist. Mm. It has had a constitutional transfer of power, and it does have internal factions.
Mm-hmm. And branches of government. Yeah.
Yeah. And it, it is also not really all that dishonest with us. It's done everything it said it was going to do. They're now saying like, look, we're not going to let you back out until it's painful for you, because we don't trust you. You're just going to start this again,
right?
If we don't make you hurt, which means that Trump can't back out.
It was in the fucking, like, the premise of these negotiations is that first, right, we strangle the Iranians, sit them down at the table, force them to make a deal on nuclear. Okay. And then after that's done, then we move on to ballistic missiles. And then after that, we move on to the regime change. They knew, right? Because we had told them that this was a long drawn out process where various different means of coercion, sanctions, of course, increasing sanctions or leaving the terrible sanctions that are on right now would be applied, but also assassinations, as we've seen, and also war, right? So they were under no illusion about what this was going. I'm not a defensist of the Iranian regime, if you want to call that, or Iranian state, but I'll say the same thing about the Iranian state that I'll say about the Zionist entity, as people want to call it, or Israel, the kind of shit that me and Andy have been talking about for years now at this point. You and I have been talking about for years. In what sense, for good or for ill, is the Iranian Islamic Republic different from a bog standard capitalist state? There are ways that it... Say again?
It's sanctioned.
it's sanctioned. That's one main external one, right? Exogenous aspect that's different is they are sanctioned, right? But they have branches of governments. They have a constitution.
It's a theocratic constitutional republic.
Right.
It is a hybrid form.
I was at an ILC function yesterday, and there showed up an Iranian Marxist. We were all discussing things, and I floated to him a half cocked idea, but one that's been floated through my head, which is, of course, that, like, whether it's the United States or whether it's Iran or whether it's Russia or Ukraine or Senegal or whatever, there is a spectrum of political thought, you know, that is acceptable. In the United States, we know it's Democrats and Republicans. And there are various different means within each of those states in which, like, ideas that are anathema to, like, the particular constitutional order are kept outside and kept external. In the United States, I think we as leftists, as socialists or whatever, are very, very aware, but maybe more so over the last 10 years, about the ways in which political parties and people are filtered out of the process, right? Some combination of media, the party system, primaries, lawsuits, whatever the case may be, right? Donations, obviously, right? In Iran, and this is not to defend it, it's only to say that these are similar operating principles that happen in different ways. It's a council of experts. It's essentially like a judicial branch on top that exists on top of the political structure that filters out acceptable candidates and allows acceptable candidates in. And on top of that, there are all sorts of social laws, you know, cultural laws, Islamic laws that are in place, which are, like all laws, enforced strictly in some cases and completely unenforced in others. And how they're enforced changes with time, backwards and forwards. It's not getting any quote unquote better or any worse. It's just based on the politics of the nation at that time. So all I'm trying to say is that capitalist states, republics in this case, the United States and Iran, like, are we even all that different? Is the Iranian state all that different from the Israeli state? Like, are there any capitalist states?
I would say the Israeli state is a good proxy.
A proxy.
Because the Israeli state is a religio-ethnic state.
Right.
I mean, and actually, to be fair,
closer
to the Iranians, they're more inclusive.
Mm-hmm. Zoroastrians and Jews, I think, get guaranteed seats in the Congress. Isn't that right?
In Iran? It's not like all the Iranian Christians were wiped out either. So, like, things got worse for them, absolutely. But
all of this isn't to say, again, isn't to be like a knee-jerk defensist of Iran. It's only to say that, like, a lot of these differences we can chalk up to intranational politics between ruling classes. The United States has had, and it said this directly in the Wall Street Journal today, which I was reading at the library, you know, Donald Trump has had since 1979 what we would recognize if this was anywhere except the secular, rational, capitalist, liberal United States. We were recognized as like a tribal blood feud with the Iranian people since 1979. He's been going on for decades about how American honor is at stake, how we need vengeance, how these mullahs are subhuman, and that all we have to destroy them, and blah blah blah. Like, this is politics between different capitalist states, and the mutual, or at least our inability to recognize them as such, is, I think, a great limitation of our politics and our understanding. And I mean that broadly, not as leftists, but as like Americans, right? To not recognize ourselves in the Iranian state, or certainly not to recognize Israel in the Iranian state.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to, like, deal with a couple of things very concretely. I think a lot was, someone would ask me, like, was everything going on in the last year a color revolution? Like, it's all just CIA stuff. And I'm like, no, there's no evidence for that. Mm-hmm. There is evidence, however, that the various intelligence agencies are attracted to anything organic or inorganic, like flies to shit. And that has to be accounted for. And a lot of leftists accounted for it with the CIA's control everything. Other people are completely and totally fucking naive about the intelligence operations being anywhere there's a rebellion, and by multiple sides. And it's also clear that a lot of protesters were killed in the last year. They were. I don't think there's any way around that. I don't think they were all American proxies either. Here's a couple of things I can say, however. One, the only faction that I know of that's particularly friendly to Israel, you know, are the Shahists, who are not who are not very popular, except apparently there's been some nostalgia for them promoted amongst Iranian Zoomers in contact with outsiders. The People's Mujahideen are even more marginal. So that's the MEK. They're an even weirder group that was a revolutionary Shia group, different from the people around the Revolutionary Guard.
Kind of inflected with like a vulgar Marxism, as I understand it, right?
Yeah.
This kind of bizarre synthesis.
Yeah, although they deny that they're Marxist, but yeah. And you know, there's been some talk, you know, from like people around Rubio that, you know, they're going to be empowered. That doesn't seem to be remotely the case.
Those are the Chalabis, but yeah.
Yeah. So are the Pavlovis, really. So what do we got left? They're attacking the internal opposition factions that would have their own political legitimacy. I don't know how you interpret that other than you want to install an outsider government. Trump may believe that the people will rise up and replace the government.
Mm-hmm.
But with what exactly?
With what?
This is not a time period where you can just throw a bunch of like small arms out and it all just go well. And it's also very clear that the Iranian government had not lost total legitimacy.
Yeah, no.
It may have been weakened in the last 2 or 3 years, mostly because of the economic effects of the sanctions. But it hadn't been destroyed, and you know, if you historically, the two things, if you want to unify a people, the two things historically that we learned from the 20th century, you do sanction them and then attack them primarily with air power. There's almost no example of that not leading to a replacement regime that was even more hostile than the one you overthrew, if you overthrew it in the first place.
We gave the Islamic Republic their September 12th moment, right? We've given it to it several times at this point. I get the sense that I'm not on the ground. I've never been to Iran, although I would love to visit someday. Perhaps when the Shah Pahlavi's back, we'll all get a chance to go hang out and like kick it with the
OnlyFans influencers. I would love to visit influencers. Iran, but I'm not going to go when Shah Pahlavi's in charge.
I'm joking. I've got no desire to go under a Shah. It's telling, right, when we talk this out, right? Because obviously we're talking this out. There are people who sit in dark rooms and think tanks and universities and the White House and the Pentagon who talk these things out too. You know, the MEK is a crackpot ideological remnant of the politics of the 1970s, it seems to me, in Iran, which has now taken on a diaspora character and made it even more crackpot, being part of American regime change operations, I think, will do that to a group. I think the Pahlavi people also, too, completely crackpot. This idea of like bringing a monarchy in, I guess, has the advantage that at one point the Shah kind of, for like a couple decades, kept this heady brew of ethnicities and ideologies and sects vaguely together until he didn't. And I guess the implication is that his son can do that again, although that seems very unlikely to me. What's missing from this whole thing, of course, are like popular forces, which everybody nods to, right? Trump will nod to and say it's time for the people, you know, be careful when you hear that word, the people of Iran to rise up and overthrow their oppressors, blah, blah, blah. What faction of Iranian society do we suppose is going to implement democracy or like a non-Islamic republic? Is it the Bazaaris? Is it the indigenous capitalist class? Because from what I know of the history, and I know from talking to people like Arya Zahidi, friend of mine, and reading other things, the Bazaaris were instrumental in their alliance with the clerics in being a essentially counter-revolutionary force against the left, and really it was their it was only by winning them over that the clerics were actually able to solidify control, because the Bazaaris and the markets, the native capitalist class, of course, is who you would look to if you were like the United States or the West in trying to like implement like a new liberal democracy in that region. But there's no sense to me that the Bazaaris or the working class, broadly conceived, or even, I guess, there's aspects of the middle class, but not even like a majority of the middle class, it seems to me, has any sort of vision or any sort of drive that might unite Iran in a new non-theocratic way. But maybe I'm missing something. What do you think?
I got nothing, man.
You got nothing.
I don't think I mean, like, here's the thing. I think we have to accept that even if the Islamic Republic was becoming more unpopular for a variety of reasons, that there is no force more popular than it. No singular force more popular than it. And, you know, that is not to justify or be an apologist for the regime, but I actually am thinking of a Iranian proverb right now. This is a Persian proverb. When an egg cracks from within, the bird is going to fly. Mm. When an egg cracks from without, it's about to be cooked.
Mm.
And I really do think that, yes, there's always, I mean, like, you know, Gene and I were talking about this on assets and color revolutions, and like, there's always state involvement, but like, it's rich for Marxists to pretend like everything's illegitimate because their state involvement, because how the hell did Lenin get back into into Imperial Russia, but the German high command still putting him on a secret chain.
Yeah.
And Lenin took advantage of that. Does that make the Bolsheviks illegitimate? Like, I mean, I know some anarchists who would say so, and I know some conservatives who would say so.
Yeah, I know some fascists who would say so, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But in general, no. However, it does not seem like the administration of Iran had currently been so damaged that it had lost all internal legitimacy, even if it had real outbreaks of real problems. I know that leftists like clean stories where there's clear good guys and clear bad guys, whether it's the people revolting against the government or the Islamic Republic itself. But I am tired of proffering that kind of analysis, because it doesn't get you anywhere. Like, it is very clear, however, here that Israel did not want Trump to make a deal with the Iranians. Israel has gotten what it wanted. It seems like from everything released, and sometimes we should take these people at their words, they believed that they could just Maduro this and let the government stand, and it was done. Even had some probably Platt adjacent people arguing that on my stream yesterday.
I saw you yell at them, yeah. Like, get off my fucking feet. Get off my lawn, you told them. Yeah. I didn't see what they were arguing, but you were probably right.
Yeah, no, they were just talking about how there was a clear plan and blah blah blah. And I'm like, look, the justification for this has changed every 5 minutes.
You don't have to you don't have to try to ascribe rationality where it's not there. You can say that, like, there is something rational to there's like a cunning of history that gave rise to Trump, and that he is this like figure that this world historical figure. You can say all these things without ascribing to him a rationality which isn't really there. There is something at work. If we're going to look for color revolutions, like, maybe we look closer to home, right? Like, I don't think it's maybe an accident that as American unipolar dominance has subsided, and as political forces in the United States, Trump, but not just Trump, have kind of buffeted the quote-unquote establishment on national security, geopolitics, the domestic sphere, whatever. It's not an accident that, like, this has created an opening for, like, at least a series of soft color revolutions within the national security establishment. Like, instead of imagining that the tail is solely wagging the dog, that, like, a Jewish cabal or a Zionist cabal is running U.S. foreign policy and has run U.S. foreign policy, I guess, since 1948. Instead, we should look at and think about, why is it that we now, under Trump, but not just under Trump, under Biden too, seem to be outsourcing our foreign policy to other nations in a way that we hadn't previously. There had been broader strategies, famously, you know, Kennan, right? And you know, coming out of the Second World War, there were great American geopolitical strategies for keeping a capitalist empire going. Now we have allowed ourselves in our dotage as an empire to be susceptible to all sorts of outside forces, quote unquote, like the Israelis, but also like the MEK, like let's just be honest, the Ukrainians, the Zelensky, the Azov battalion folks, like the hard nationalists in Ukraine. We've allowed ourselves to, like, outsource in a lot of ways our foreign policy to these countries. And I think that says as much about American power and where we're going right now as it says about, like, purported color revolutions or, like, outside influences in the world. Because I do think that something has changed, and it's become so visible because American strategy in the core is kind of liquidating itself, as a lot of the, you know, when I read the New York Times the New York Post, and I was also reading the Wall Street Journal today, these people are making the same fucking arguments. The neocons, let's call them, are making the same arguments they did in 2002, 2003, like nothing fucking changed. It's like there is a zombie foreign policy, right, that still exists ideologically in this country, but there's also things happening below the surface, I think, that show that we're in a kind of terminal.
Even they are having internal defectors, like the actual real historical neocons. Mm-hmm. Some of the most bellicose of them, like John Bolton, are like, signaling that they think that this regime, that the Trump regime, by this regime is what I mean, has overstepped its bounds. And Bolton was one of the architects of everything that Seymour Hersh was afraid of.
Famously was kicked out of the first Trump administration for being too hawkish on Iran, and now he's critiquing I guess, this move because of its recklessness, right?
Eric Prince is publicly critiquing the administration for being reckless and for not listening to him and saying that the strike was unnecessary, and now they're in a war that they cannot back out of.
Reckless was also what the August New York Times editorial board called it. So this is, you were mentioning Democrats before, this is the, I think, the limits of the critique you'll get from not just neocons, but like center of the road Democrats and center of the road Republicans. It's not that, of course, prosecuting this war outside the bounds of Congress, breaking numerous aspects of international law, like that fucking matters anymore. Various different war crimes, none of this matters. What matters is that it's not done in an effective way. It's too reckless, right? That the preparation wasn't done either on the ground with like American assets, military assets, but importantly too, that it was not done to convince the American people, as it was so effectively in 2002, 2003, to get behind this action, because that's very glaring in this. Something like only a quarter of Americans support this action, and it's incredible that it's going off anyway, and we're getting such tepid pushback from the politicians.
I mean, we could address that it looks very clear that Hakeem Jeffries slow wrote out his new War Powers Act. So that this could have been so that the Trump administration could have started it before they tried to do anything, if which has two effects. One is it makes them look like they're standing against the war, even if they're not. And two, we're already committed and we can't back out, so it doesn't matter. Like, they're not going to be able to strip it anyway. I also think, like, when we talk about Congress declaring war, they haven't fucking done that since World War II.
No.
But now they're not even doing the we're going to brief Congress. We've now had, what, two major military actions with no brief. This time it took forever to Trump to even address the public. All we got was pictures circulating out from the White House of him yelling at Hegseth that was seen through a window.
Yeah.
Then him refusing to answer questions in the Rose Garden and talking about
the first time ever.
Right.
Through both of his terms.
So there's that. I've also gotten pushback because I critiqued Hegseth. I mean, pushback probably from our Marxio neoconservative friends. Because it does seem like Hegseth thought that there was two things that are very clear. One, it now makes sense where they were pressing Anthropic to accelerate this removal of the manned operator this week. The liberals were thinking it's because they were planning on unleashing it on the United States, but it seems, and they may have been, who knows, but it does seem very clearly tied to this war.
This I don't even know. I don't even know all the backstory to that. So you'll have to inform me along with the listeners, but we're at about an hour now. Do you want to go to the paywall now?
Yeah.
We'll tell that story and much more on the other side of the paywall. We're going to go there, guys. If you are not a subscriber to This Wreckage, you can become one at patreon.com/thiswreckage. If you'd like to see our beautiful faces, us gesticulating and rolling our eyes and our angry faces, our disgust as we talk about this, you can go to patreon.com/varnvlog and watch the video recording of this. But for everybody, thanks for listening to this non-fun half, and we'll see you on the other side of the paywall.